Welcome to WMKV Health Scope, a weekly discussion of health and wellness issues for older adults, their families, and caregivers. This call-in program is presented by 89.3 WMKV. To have your medical-related question concerning today's topic answered live on the air, call 513-772-9658. That's 772-WMKV. And now, WMKV Health Scope. We welcome you to Health Scope here on 89.3 FM WMKV, and now also serving Butler and Warren counties on 89.9 WLHS. I'd like to think that this program brings you some good food for thought, and we have a chance to digest the information on this program. Now that I've gotten all my food puns out of the way, we want to welcome a very special guest, Dr. Janice Rafferty, the Chief of Colorectal Surgery Division at the University of Cincinnati with UC Physicians. And Dr. Rafferty, thank you for coming in with us to talk today about good colorectal health.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's talk for just a moment at the very beginning, before we get to the basic questions, about really what do the bowel and intestinal system, what are they, what do they do, why are they so critical to our bodily well-being? I mean, it's something that I think most of us know from basic biology, but there may be things about the intestinal system or the bowel that we really don't know.
Well, there are two sort of bowel systems that we can talk about. The first one is the small bowel or the small intestine, and that's where all of our nutrition is absorbed. So anything that you eat goes, over the lips and past the tongue, and then down into the stomach, where its acid and other digestive juices are added, and then into the small intestine. And small intestine is where all of the stuff that we need to live is absorbed. So it's critical that you have healthy small intestine. Whatever's not absorbed by the small intestine, the undigested or unabsorbed food stuff, like fiber, peels, rinds, stringy stuff that we eat, whatever's not absorbed is then dumped into the colon over on the right side by where the appendix is. And then the colon will absorb some water and push that leftover stuff forward toward the anus, where it will come out as a bowel movement. Mm-hmm. Now, the colon, the function of the colon really is to slow things down from point A to point B so that you have warning and you have time and a call, as we say, to have a bowel movement. So the colon's function is really to maybe absorb a little bit of water, but then to sort of give you time to know that you're going to have a bowel movement and get to the right place for that
exactly.
Function.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think some people, just as they do with their urinary system, they say, boy, I can really, quote unquote, hold it for a long time. That's not always the healthiest thing for your bowels. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I was just discussing this with a friend last night. The average or the healthy number of bowel movements per week is about 3. You don't have to go every day. There are a lot of people who have grown up thinking that you have to have a bowel movement every day, and they will work really hard at doing that. And that's the flip side of the coin, working too hard at it, pushing, straining, grunting, groaning to actually make a bowel movement occur can actually be harmful as well. So I think that promoting a healthy diet, a diet high in fiber, high in fluids, water especially, will promote healthy colon function so that you can have, 3, 4, or 5 bowel movements a week, which would be healthy.
I'd like to come back to that whole idea of regularity later in the program, but I want to get into some of the more common bowel conditions and disorders that people tend to encounter in their life. What are some of the ones that you would like to share with us today?
We could divide them into benign disorders, and then we can also talk about malignant or cancerous disorders. Of course, a cause near and dear to my heart is colorectal cancer.
Yes.
And that is one of the most common things that affects the colon, especially in Americans as they age. The risk of having colorectal cancer once you reach the age of 50, with no family history of polyp or cancer formation in the colon, is about 6%. So that's why we recommend that various screening modalities start occurring around the age of 50. Now, the other things that can occur with the colon that many people suffer from throughout their life are benign conditions like diverticulitis.
Which I understand can be quite painful.
Indeed it can. Indeed
yes.
It can. And then, of course, constipation and other functional disorders that make it more difficult. Chronic diarrhea, chronic constipation, those sorts of things are probably perhaps some of the more common. And then we can talk about things like inflammatory bowel disease, which includes ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, which can cause inflammation of the lining of the intestine that can also cause pain and bleeding, weight loss, those sorts of things.
When we talk about the different causes, let's go back to colorectal cancer for just a moment. We hear about things like colonoscopies, the importance of having a colonoscopy. We hear about things like polyps and whatnot. What causes colorectal cancer?
Boy, that's a great question. I wish I could answer that.
You'd be picking up the Pulitzer.
That's right. Yeah, I'd be picking up a whole lot more than that, too, I'm sure. We don't really know what causes it. We do know what risk factors increase your chances of having colorectal cancer. Perhaps one of the ones that everyone can know about is their family history. So a family history of colorectal cancer markedly increases your risk. But there are other cancers that run in families that can increase your risk or your suspicion that there could be something going amiss with the colon as well. So breast cancer is associated in certain patients with colorectal cancer. Cancer of the uterus, ovary, stomach, pancreas, other organs they sort of travel on the same gene, I guess you could say, the same area of the genome that cause cancer. So that is perhaps one of the risk factors, family history. But there are other things. Age is perhaps the biggest risk factor. As we age, our risk for colorectal cancer goes up. A diet low in fiber, obesity, lack of exercise, those sorts of things. We know, the unhealthy diet is perhaps the most common because, if you think about it, what goes in must come out, and it has to go through the colon.
And we'll come back. I'd like to come back to the whole idea of the colonoscopy. And I know for many people, they say, boy, I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to talk about this.
Right.
But it really is very important when you hit that age 50, or if you have family history of any kind of cancer in that area, is it better to do that a little bit, to have a colonoscopy earlier? Or it really is 50 kind of still the hallmark?
It's 50 if you have no symptoms and no family history. But if you have a family history, we recommend you start at the age of 40.
Gotcha.
However, if you have a first-degree relative who was diagnosed under the age of 50, you should start your screening process even earlier than that. And we say, on average, 10 years before the age at which they were diagnosed. So let's say your mother was diagnosed with colorectal cancer when she was 42. You should start having your exams around the age of 32, believe it or not.
Right, so. Because quite often, I mean, how quickly does colorectal cancer develop? I mean, we keep hearing that if you can catch this early and if you can have, whether it's a polyp or some kind of a growth, removed, biopsied, and whatnot, it can be often treated and it can be successfully treated.
That's really exactly right.
A while, though, for it to come on. And quite often, you don't know that there's an issue until there are symptoms, unless you are checked. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. You know, if you look at the law of averages, and you took, thousands of patients with a polyp, and we followed their natural history, it would take, on average, about 10 years for a polyp, when it first starts to form, to turn into a cancer. About 10 years. So that's why the current recommendation for surveillance starts at the age of 50, and then every 10 years afterwards, if no polyps are found and there are no symptoms or family history. Now, that being said, every polyp, every colorectal cancer has its own idea of how things should go. Every polyp has its own biology, as we say, in the profession.
Sure.
So certain polyps are very aggressive and they very quickly turn into a cancer. Other polyps are very slow growing and may never turn into a cancer. That's the minority of polyps. But if you look at the average, from the minute it starts to grow until a cancer could be found in a polyp, it's about 10 years.
Very good. If you're just joining us here on HealthScope, Dr. Janice Rafferty is here with us. She is the chief of colorectal surgery in the colorectal surgery division at UC with UC Physicians. You can find out a lot more at 513-291-DOCS, D-O-C-S. And we are talking today about good colorectal health with Dr. Janice Rafferty. You can also join us by phone if you'd like to call in with a question at 513-772-9658. or at 877-772-9658. You can also find out more online at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. Always good information. Did I get it, Deb? 298
docs.
298, what? I said the wrong number. 298 docs. I'll make sure I got that right. 513-298 docs. I must have said something wrong, but I don't want to repeat what I said wrong. Let's talk about some of the more benign issues. We can always revisit colorectal cancer because that is one of the real areas that I think a lot of people who suffer from colorectal cancer find way too late that it was something that could have been treated and found earlier. But let's talk about a few of the more benign bowel diseases at this point. You mentioned diverticulitis.
Yes.
I'm happy to say I've never had diverticulitis, but I've heard from people who thought that they were literally going to die.
Yes.
I mean, what is diverticulitis and what causes this?
So the root cause is what we call diverticulosis. Diverticulosis is the development of little benign pockets in usually the left side of the colon. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans, as they age, will develop diverticulosis. It's a completely benign, symptom-free condition, often found on colonoscopy without any other findings that are worrisome at all. So diverticulosis is incredibly common, and it develops because of patients that have a chronically low fiber diet. You know, It's fascinating if you think about why we're on a low fiber diet. Back in the old days, as I can now say, it was a sign of wealth to be able to eat white bread because all of the fiber was milled out of it. It's the fiber that makes it dark and brown. So when you mill the fiber out and you have white bread, it's very low in fiber, but it's a sign of, you know, prosperity. And then they take that fiber today and they sell it back to us as psyllium husk, which is I think kind of tricky. But what we need to add to our diets is high fiber foods and psyllium husk potentially if you are unable to get fiber in other ways. So diverticulosis develops because of a chronic low fiber diet. And we start our kids on this when they're very, very young. So if a diverticulum, which is a diverticulosis benign condition, if it gets inflamed and infected, then the wall of the colon becomes thickened and it hurts. And it can even cause infection, abscess, these sorts of things. And that really, it really, really does hurt. So diverticulitis occurs in about 25% of patients who have diverticulosis. So just because you have diverticulosis and your gastroenterologist mentions to you after your colonoscopy that you have it, doesn't mean that you're going to have a problem. But if you know that you have it, it probably would behoove you to try to get 30 grams of insoluble fiber in your diet every day to hopefully prevent future problems.
And we'll come back to that because a big part of this is really having a decent diet, no matter whether you have diverticulosis or not, but having a decent diet. We'll also come back to some of the other, I guess, what as you put them, I guess it was benign bowel
conditions
in just a moment. But we have Pam from California joining us by phone, 513-772-9658, or our toll-free number, 877-772-9658. Pam, thank you for holding on. You're on with Dr. Janice Rafferty from UC Physicians.
Oh, good day.
Thank you.
I'm trying to figure out how to word this delicately. By the way, my mother has had both colon cancer and breast cancer, so I get my colonoscopies, et cetera, and the mammograms, and so far I'm in good shape.
Good. That's great.
What I'm asking is, if you have a situation where you are attempting a bowel movement and you feel as though there's something in there that isn't quite coming out, are you suggesting that rather than straining and trying to force it, you just let, you know, do what's easily done, and then in a day or two hope that everything else will come out on its own good time? The last colonoscopy, and I did do the cleanse and everything. I thought everything was great, and they actually did have to go in there and, well, give me a couple of enemas. So I do tend to be very slow to move,
slow transit,
but then
sure.
eventually it happens. Mm-hmm. And how can you put that any more delicately?
Oh, I think you worded it very well, Pam. And the same thing, I also understand having a daughter who had issues similar to what Pam's talking about, without embarrassing my kid. But you don't want to become impacted, though, either.
Right. That's right.
So can you talk a little bit about that, Dr. Rafferty, about...
Yep. You know, as I said, it's healthy to have on average about 3 bowel movements per week, and whatever you need to do to promote that, high fiber, high fluid, potentially stool softeners like a mineral oil emulsion, occasionally a glycerin suppository or a small soapy enema. Is okay to help evacuate if you feel like there's something there that can't come out. And any of those alternatives would be healthier than sitting and straining and, you know, grunting and groaning and turning blue in the face to try to get that stool to pass.
Yes.
Yeah, that can do all sorts of bad things to many areas of your body, including the pelvic floor, which is another thing that we can talk about when we talk about healthy toileting habits.
What about some of the fiber... I think they're fiber powders. Would it be preferable to, and then there's something I know that they used to advertise that you would take every day. Mm-hmm. Are any of those any good, or would you prefer the glycerin and the oils, et cetera?
I think adding a fiber supplement to your daily regimen is a healthy thing to do. I would recommend you look for an insoluble fiber, one that increases the bulk in stool, to get sort of the biggest bang for your buck. But perhaps the most important thing you do is eat a high fiber diet. And the best way to know what foods are high in fiber would be to just Google it. Go to Dr. Google and find out.
Old Dr. Google.
That's right. Google high fiber food list, and you'll get a list of, you know, wonderful cereals, and it will describe the fiber content in berries and nuts and beans and other vegetables. It's very interesting. I often have patients come to my office who say, oh, doc, I'm on a very high fiber diet. And I say, now tell me what high fiber foods you eat. And they'll say, well, I eat a bowl of oatmeal every day. And if you look at the list, that has just a few grams of fiber in it. So you're about a tenth of the way.
But the marketing tells them it's full of fiber.
Right. And you know what? Oatmeal and other oats, grains are very good to eat, but you want to look at your diet and you want it all to add up to about 30, that's 30, not 1-3, 30
about
grams
salad.
Per day. Salad is good. But again, if you look at the list, you'll find out that it has much less fiber content than you think it does. Take a look.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Very good. Pam, thank you for a very interesting call. We appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you so much. And when... Because a lot of the fluid or a lot of the water drains out or is filtered out of the feces in that colon area. So that's why sometimes it can be sometimes a little hard to go there.
Sure.
And there are times where we need, but I think if I understood correctly, what you're saying is if we can kind of do it naturally without having to worry about suddenly having to take that laxative or something.
Correct.
And we can do something on a more regular basis, so to speak, and pun intended, I guess, there. Now, if I am going once a day, is that too many then?
Is everybody different? Everyone's
different.
That's right. But, you know, there are patients who get very stressed out if they don't go once a day. And they'll really, really work to have that daily bowel movement. And I guess my message would be, you know, don't stress. Don't get too worried about not having a bowel movement every day. As long as you're having easy, soft bowel movements and it occurs at least 3-4 times a week, you're in good shape.
Very good. We have Dr. Janice Rafferty here with us. We're going to take a quick break here on HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS. Again, if you want to find out more about Dr. Rafferty or any of the UC physicians, she is the chief of colorectal surgery division at the University of Cincinnati. She's doing her
flexing.
Her flexing here, showing off her guns.
That's right.
So there you go. 513-298-DOCS. That's D-O-C-S, 513-298-DOCS. You can find out more as well at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. And Dr. Janice Rafferty will be back with us in the second half of HealthScope here on WMKV and WLHS. Stay with us. The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff and management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice. And we're here on WMKV and WLHS. It's Health Scope with Dr. Janice Rafferty, our special guest. Today, the Chief of Colorectal Surgery Division at the University of Cincinnati, UC Physicians, and wonderful to have her here with. Thank you for taking time today. I know it was a surgery day, busy day for you.
Yes,
so
indeed.
Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Let's talk, before we get back to colorectal cancer, colonoscopies, and that kind of prevention, which is really one of the main messages I think we have today. I still want to talk a little bit more about some of the symptoms. Obviously, if we are having pain, I guess, but lack of regularity might be another thing. What are some of the symptoms that we might have a bowel issue of some kind?
Well, the most common symptom of colorectal cancer is no symptom at all. So that's why
that's scary.
Yeah. So that's why it's critical to understand the screening and surveillance guidelines. However, if there are symptoms, obviously we always worry and need to investigate the presence of blood with a bowel movement. When I see a patient who tells me they have blood with bowel movements, things that I want to know are what color is the blood? Is it just on the toilet tissue? Is it dripping into the bowl? Or is it mixed in with the stool? Because all of those tell me something differently.
Yes.
We also worry about things like bloating and cramping associated with bleeding with bowel movements. Perhaps one of the, you know, patients love to self-diagnose. They see blood and they say, oh my goodness, my hemorrhoids are acting up. And you know, when you're 20, that's probably an okay thing to think. But when you start getting, you know, over 35 or 40, and you say, oh, it's just my hemorrhoids acting up, that's not paying attention to the signals that your body is sending you. If you see blood, you need to have it investigated. And far more often than not, it's something completely benign, like a hemorrhoid or a fissure or a little bit of inflammation in the lining of the anus or the rectum. But you know what? It needs to be investigated, and you need to be sure that it's nothing else.
When in doubt, check, especially
Absolutely.
As we get older.
That's
and,
right.
And you were mentioning the fact that some of these things that can happen to our bowels can be exacerbated by age. I mean, it
sure.
definitely, we're not getting younger. We're not spring chickens in some cases. And if you're starting to, especially if you're having something that suddenly changes, I would think you want to talk to your doctor at that particular point.
Yep. And, you know, you are the one who knows best what your bowel habits are, what they have been for your entire life, and what's normal for you. And everyone's different. So if something changes, you really need to talk to your doctor and have it investigated.
How do you go about diagnosing or trying to find out or testing for the different bowel issues?
The most important thing we do is we actually sit down and talk to the patient and find out what are the symptoms, what exactly. And I tell patients, you know, just like Pam, our previous caller, she didn't know how to put it delicately. I'm not sure there's much in this profession
just
that can be put.
There.
That's right.
I
say,
lay
just
it out there.
Lay it on me. I say, you're in the colorectal surgeon's office. Let's just get down to the nitty gritty here, the down and dirty, as I say. and so I think talking to them about their specific worries and issues. How exactly is your bottom bothering you? Or what exactly is it that's bothering you? And then we sort of take it from there. If someone has painless bleeding, they're bleeding with bowel movements with absolutely no other symptoms, as a colorectal surgeon, as a proctologist, as a gastroenterologist, what we're going to do as primary care doc is, well, we're going to take a look. And I have patients look at me, great big eyes. Are you really going to look at that, doc? And I say, well, of course I am. If you came in with an earache, I'd look in your ear.
Exactly.
If you're going to come in with something going on with your bottom, I got to look at your bottom. So if you have a problem, you need to be prepared that your doctor is going to take a good and thorough look. So the first thing we do is we just look, and then we do a little further examination in the office to figure out if there's anything going on within about 5 or 6 inches of the anal canal, of the anus, of the hemorrhoids. We can look up a short distance in the office. But if there's nothing there, you really do need a colonoscopy. And a colonoscopy is perhaps today one of the very best ways to diagnose what exactly is going on with the colon that could be causing the symptoms that the patient complains of. And you mentioned before that people will say, I just don't want to have a colonoscopy. You know, and I tell everyone, And I say to patients who say that, really the worst part is the prep, and you're in complete control
of
the prep.
That's everything I hear from everybody.
Yep. It's just the prep. And no matter what prep your doctor gives you, it's going to cause probably some cramping, maybe a little bit of nausea. It's going to cause diarrhea, because that's what it's supposed to do as it cleans out your colon. The doctor has to get a very good look at the lining of your colon, and if it's not cleaned out, we can't see anything, and we're going to tell you we got to bring you back, and then you got to do the prep all over again.
Yeah, and that's no fun.
Right.
You don't want to do it twice. And the thing, I guess, to try to keep in mind is, forgive, I can't do anything without a pun on this today, this too shall pass.
Yes, indeed.
As miserable as you might be, you realize that by tomorrow at this time,
you're going to be at Bob Evans eating the sausage, gravy, and biscuits. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you go. I don't know how much fiber's in there. But anyway,
Not much, but go ahead.
So it's
the prep that's the worst part. And
right.
All the prep, you know, they all taste bad. You just got to kind of soldier through it and get yourself some nice fluffy toilet paper and some nice maybe ointment for your backside. And then the next day you go into your doctor. They're going to put an IV in. They're going to give you some great medication to make you nice and sleepy. And the next thing you know, it's over. It's over.
I imagine some people come out of it, whether it's twilight or whether it's a full anesthesia, and they're like, when do we start?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's really funny.
The best feeling is when they say, it's already over.
Yeah.
You're done.
In the recovery room, and they're giving you free rein to, you know.
Suddenly, you can eat again.
Break wind. Right. And they're actually encouraging that, which, you know, we tend not to do in other areas of our lives.
Right.
Yeah, and they say, well, when are we going to get started? Well, gosh, it's already over.
But when it really comes to looking beyond that first several inches, if you will, of the rear end, if you will, it pretty much is a colonoscopy. That's your main tool at this point. Is that correct? Or are there other options?
You know, there are many different ways to look at the colon. A colonoscopy is perhaps the best way to get a look at the entire colon and the very sort of end, so to speak, of the small intestine where it hooks into the colon. There are shorter scopes that just get a good look at the left side of the colon. There are X-ray tests that we can do to look at the colon as well, like, you know, an old-fashioned barium enema will tell us if there are narrowed areas, if there are kinks or twists or hairpin curves, if there are other things going on with the colon. Sometimes a barium enema is helpful. There's also, you know, the new fancy stuff. There is what we call CT colonography, which is a fancy way of saying virtual colonoscopy. And really, it's a fancy CAT scan with special software where the radiologist will reconstruct the colon, and then they can look at it, and it's interesting to watch.
Wow.
It's almost like driving. It's almost like playing a video game. They're sort of driving through the colon, and they see the lining. Now, if you're going to do that, guess what? You still have to do. You still have to do the prep.
Right, because you still have to be able to see what's going on,
and you
can't have other things in the way.
That's right. So even if you're going to do a virtual colonoscopy or a CT colonography, you have to do a prep. And so that's a neat and sort of fancy way to do it. No sedation is required, which is really one of the benefits of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have a colonoscopy and you get sedation, you can't, you know, drive your forklift home. You can't, you know, sign your will that day.
Do not operate any heavy machinery.
That's right. You can't sign your will that day or, you know, change your trust. But if you have a CT colonography, there is no sedation, so you can do whatever you want for the rest of the day.
And for those people who may not have the support system to have somebody to drive them to and from an appointment, that may be a very good
option.
It sure beats not knowing.
Now, here's
one way or the other.
That's right. Now, here's the thing. If they find something on the CT colonography, probably going to recommend that we get a colonoscopy to make sure that it's something real and not just
a blip or
a piece of stool stuck to the wall of the colon that kind of looks like a polyp. I mean, the technology today is so good that they can almost always tell exactly what it is. But without tissue, you know, tissue is the issue, as my favorite pathologist likes to say. If we don't have tissue, it's kind of hard to talk a patient into an operation when you don't have a true diagnosis yet.
Exactly. Dr. Janice Rafferty is here with us. She is the Chief of Colorectal Surgery Division at the University of Cincinnati with UC Physicians. You can find out more at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. And the phone number to find out anything about the physicians and the doctors at UC Health, 513-298-DOCS. And we thank Deb Teitelbaum and an incredible team they like to pinch Bob Hannigan, but that's a whole nother show. But we have Dr. Janice Rafferty here with us. By the way, we have a few minutes left in the show. If you would like to join us and join the conversation, 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. When we talk about proper nutrition and a healthy diet, you've been talking about non-soluble fiber. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How do we know what is soluble versus non-soluble? When we see all these packages, and as we were even saying, is the package is packed with fiber.
That's right.
But all fiber is not created equal. Is that what you're telling me?
Absolutely not. So okay. what I like to tell patients, you know, it's insoluble if it's kind of gritty and not that pleasant to drink.
Okay.
The stuff that's easy to take is useful in certain situations. But if what you want to maintain is healthy motility and high bulk in your stool, what's most beneficial is insoluble fiber. And that is there's no other way to say it. It's kind of gritty. It's kind of unpleasant to drink, but it's really promoting health. Now, I'll have patients come in who are really following a high-fiber diet, and they'll keep a food diary for me, and they'll show me what they're eating every day. And they're having lots of beans and fruits.
Fruits and berries. Would be a biggie.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, there are also cereals out there that have a lot of fiber in them. And I encourage all of the listeners out there to go to the grocery store, go to the cereal aisle, and look at the cereals that say they're high in fiber and read the side of the box, because it's really very informative. There are some out there that have, it says high fiber on the front. You look at the side and it's 2 or 3 grams. Now, that's not that much, really. There are some out there that have 12 or 13 grams in a serving. And if you think about that, you're almost halfway there.
Oh, exactly, because 30 is the magic number.
30 is the magic number.
30 grams per day.
That's right.
Can we get too much fiber? Is it possible? In other words, if you go a little over the 30, I guess is what I'm asking. If you go over the 30, it's not necessarily
not bad.
Going to hurt you necessarily.
Correct.
I mean, now, anything out of moderation is not good. We know that.
This is correct.
Right.
This is correct. Now, I will tell you that in third world countries where they don't have all of the milling process, the processed foods that we have, they never see diverticulitis in third world countries, but what they do see is colons that become really, really big and long and kind of twisty. And that's the flip side of getting too much fiber for too long. You'll develop, a really big sort of redundant twisty colon. Now, that's not going to happen in the United States for the most part because, we don't start feeding our babies here, berries from the tree out in the front yard. But in third world countries, you can get too much fiber. So
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Okay. You're right. Everything in moderation.
If we don't want to do the supplements, what are the best foods that you could recommend that would give us fiber?
Mm-hmm. So things like black beans, kidney beans. I can't advocate a high fiber cereal enough because it's so easy to do. And if you don't like cereal, that's okay. You can stir it into yogurt, and then you've got sort of crunchy yogurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
So cereal, beans. There are certain berries that have lots. I think raspberries have a lot of fiber in them, if I'm not mistaken. Strawberries have a lot of fiber in them as well, which, by the way, leads me to dispelling another myth about seeds. So if you have diverticulosis, you may think, oh, my goodness, I'm not supposed to eat seeds. And I'll have patients come in, and they won't eat tomatoes, and they won't eat strawberries, and they won't eat cucumbers because they're seeds. And if you think about it, you look at all of the foods that have seeds, they're all of the ones that have high fiber.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And so the old wives
tale. So they're talking themselves out of eating good fiber foods.
Well, you know what? And it's what we say. It's an urban legend, old wives tale.
A spouse's tale in today's society.
A spouse's tale, right. It's an old spouse tale. I think what happens is that patients, when they eat those foods that are high in fiber, they'll develop a little bit of, left lower quadrant pain. And, oh, my goodness, is that my diverticulitis acting up again? But what it is it's giving your stool bulk and it's making your colon work to push that bulky stool through, and that can hurt a little bit. But no one has ever found, in my surgical experience or the history of surgical experience, as far as I know, you know, somebody who has perforated diverticulitis, and the culprit, when you open them up and look, is that kernel of popcorn sitting there or that cucumber seed. So what I would say to folks out there who are limiting their diet severely from seeds because they have diverticulosis, I would say, get back on that seed wagon. Go ahead and eat the strawberries and the cucumbers and the tomatoes. Eat a healthy diet. Drink lots of fluids, and that's the best thing for your colon.
And I was going to say, the other thing that I think is very good, and I know that physicians' time is so valuable, but so is ours as a patient.
Of course, yes.
That if you have questions about your diet and you want to get some clarification, most physicians, because that's the ounce of prevention right there in many cases, are willing to take a little bit of time to talk with you about, you know, say, I'm looking for a good high-fiber diet, but the right kind of fiber and what's going to be good for me and things like that.
Yep.
And odds are that physician knows your health history better than maybe everybody but you.
That's right.
That's very important. Once again, Dr. Janice Rafferty is here with us, and we have a few minutes left at 772-9658. I wanted to get to something you brought up before about the pelvic floor.
Yes.
First of all, can you define exactly what the pelvic floor is? Mm-hmm. I know this generally comes into play as we get a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
And is it men and women who have, do we both have pelvic floors?
Absolutely. So the pelvic floor is a normal part of the anatomy. And what I tell patients to sort of simplify it and give them a visual is that it's almost like a little hammock or sling of tissue, muscular tissue and fibrous tissue, tendons, etc., from the pubic bone in front to the tailbone in back. And it forms a sling. It's a little hammock upon which all of our internal organs sit. So in women, the uterus, the bladder, and the rectum sit there. And in men, it's going to be the bladder and the rectum. Now, through that sling of tissue in the very middle, there's an opening. And that's where the urethra comes through, the vagina comes through, and the rectum comes through. If that pelvic floor is not functioning normally, the patient may notice that their bladder won't empty normally and that they can't empty their rectum normally. Because to have a bowel movement, two things have to happen. Number one, your colon has to propel the stool forward.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, so to speak, the pelvic floor has to relax and allow the stool to pass. So those two things have to happen in order for a person to have a bowel movement. And when it comes to the pelvic floor, I'll often have patients say, you know, I feel that it's there, I know it's there, but it just won't come out. And that's one of the very first things that sort of raises my antennas to make me think that they might have a pelvic floor abnormality. And we have ways of figuring that out for you and helping hopefully correct the issues.
And there are treatments available for that. And I know that there are probably several different ways that you can treat a pelvic floor issue.
Absolutely.
But again, getting to the doctor and, you know, just expressing yourself, saying, look, I know that there's something going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why you're there at the doctor. You're there to get the answer, and they're there to help you figure it out.
That's right.
I'm one of those self-diagnosing people. I would drive you absolutely up the wall. We have John who's been waiting patiently on the line. John, you're on with Dr. Janice Rafferty from UC Physicians. Thanks for holding on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 17-year-old handicapped son who's non-ambulatory. He's on a blended food diet, and he also receives approximately 2 teaspoons of Miralax a day to help keep him regular. For someone like my son, would you recommend adding a fiber supplement to his diet?
Well, it sounds like it might be a little more complicated than all of that. I mean, I guess, you know, if he's on a blended diet, I would need to know a little bit more about why. If it's that he can't chew and you're putting it through a tube, that's one thing.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's a food tube diet, yes,
mm-hmm.
Correct.
So one of the problems with putting a powdered fiber through a tube is that you can plug up the tube, and then you can't use the tube for food supplements or nutrition anymore. So I would talk to your child's gastroenterologist or doctor that sees them regularly to see if a fiber supplement would help, because Miralax, which is the commercial name for polyethylene glycol, is a, you know, believe it or not, it's what we use for bowel preps for colonoscopy. It's just a measured dose. So it's one of those things that helps propel the stool through the colon, but giving the colon something more to work with, more sort of fluffy stool that has more volume to it, is always, I think, a good thing. But how to actually get that fiber in your son's diet is challenging. You know, if you use vegetables and juices that you juice, that you, you know, grind down in that special blender so that all of the fiber is still in it, and if you can, if that's something that you can put through the tube, then that's a good source of fiber, actually.
Okay. Do you yourself recommend using Miralax? Our GP has recommended that we give him that on a daily.
I think that polyethylene glycol is a great thing to use, and for chronic use, it's okay. It's not a stimulant. It won't make the colon lazy, so to speak, and it seems to work very well for many people who have slowed motility. So I think that it's it for everything we know that it's safe. It's safe for long-term use, and I don't know of people that shouldn't use it unless they have some sort of blockage in their intestine that would it would have to work against. So yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's a safe thing to use.
Great. Thank you very much for your information.
You're
Thank you, John. Thank you. And I think one of the most important things is exactly as you were saying, talking to that physician who knows the most about that health condition. It's difficult sometimes answering tough calls on the phone when you have things
sure.
like that. So once again, always defer to your own physician on that. You know, we're down into our last few minutes here with Dr. Janice Ranferty, and the time has just flown. It seems like there's so much more information, everything from better diet, more fiber, to the screenings and reminders about colonoscopies and the health screenings. Is the prevalence of colorectal cancer, is it dropping at all? Are we seeing this making any impact?
Well, you know, the prevalence has stayed about the same. I think that we are catching it a little more in the earlier stages in certain people because the awareness of the need for screening and surveillance has improved. The acceptance of screening and surveillance has improved. You know, again, back in the old days, I can now officially say that. You know, patients.
Well, you're 23 years old.
I'm 39. I'm 39, right?
Oh,
for
heck,
the like the 15th
kid.
Time. But come
you're
on,
still a kid. My goodness gracious. Anyway, but yeah,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sidetrack.
Where was I? So you know, back in the old days, the you know we would recommend fecal occult blood testing and a flexible sigmoidoscopy for surveillance. And the acceptance of that was way below 30%. And we've got it up to almost 50% now. So I think with education and public awareness announcements and other services, I think we've gotten the awareness up. I think that primary care docs are, you know, fabulous about keeping up with all of these incredibly, you know, numerous, almost too numerous to count screening and surveillance things that patients need to have as they age. And patients are a little more willing to accept it. They're a little more willing, I think, today to be proactive. And most procedures are so, you know, safe and easy to do that I think they're becoming much more aware and accepting.
And for those people who have to go through the prep for the colonoscopy, it's almost like misery loves company. Everybody says, oh, you'll get through it.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, it almost becomes a badge of courage for some people.
That's right, a badge of honor, the brown badge of honor.
There you go.
Exactly.
And just like a good book, it all comes out in the end.
That's right.
But I have to ask, you mentioned sigmoidoscopy.
Yes.
Tell us what a sigmoidoscopy is in our final moments here.
So a sigmoidoscopy is just a shorter, so to speak, colonoscopy.
Okay.
It is a shorter scope, and it just looks at the left side, the lowest part of the colon. It's about, 50 or 60 centimeters long instead of 100 and, you know, 180 centimeters long. So it really just looks at the left side of the colon.
Very good. Dr. Janice Ranferty, any tips that you could leave us with? I know we've touched upon most of these, but kind of to wrap up on the program here on HealthScope today, some of the tips that you would just leave all of us with for better bowel, colon health, what are the things that we should be doing in our lifestyle and our diet to be better at this?
First and foremost, know and understand your family history. Because if you have a family history of colon polyps, colon cancer, other solid organ tumors, you are at increased risk, and you need to pay attention to when you should start your screening exams, number one. Number two, eat a high-fiber diet. As you said, everything in moderation, but try to get 30 grams per day. Drink plenty of fluids. Get some exercise. That also helps with colon motility. And just try to pay attention to what your colon is telling you, because as I tell patients, no one dies of embarrassment.
Right.
All too many people die of colorectal cancer, so pay attention to what your colon is telling you.
And the thing, the other takeaway that I have from earlier in this program is the fact that a polyp, once discovered, or not an undiscovered polyp, it could take...
It's a bad player.
It could take 10 years, again, polyps. Every polyp is different. You never know. But it could take as many as 10 years, or it could be fast.
That's right.
And just because the doctor says, well, we found a polyp during your colonoscopy, doesn't always mean that's cancerous. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you don't want to immediately panic, but you want to get it looked at.
So many polyps, not all polyps, but many polyps are precancerous. And so when we want to find them is when they are still a polyp. They're not cancer yet. And if your doctor is able to remove that polyp during the colonoscopy, you're good to go. You've prevented cancer. Which is a great feeling.
And again, that's one of the things that I'm sure when you sign all the paperwork or whatever, saying, hey, if you find something while you're in there, so you don't have to go through it again.
That's right. Take it out.
Go ahead and take care of this.
That's
fantastic.
Right. Yep.
Well, there is hope. And if people will just listen to what the physicians are saying, myself included, on things.
Yep. But Stop self-diagnosing.
That's right. Yeah. Dr. Janice Rafferty, thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you to Deb Teitelbaum, too. And I'll pinch Bob for you on that.
That's right.
Dr. Janice Rafferty is the chief of the colorectal surgery division, easy for me to say, with UC Physicians. More information at 513-298-DOCS. D-O-C-S. You can find out more as well at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. Always good information. Dr. Rafferty, thank you again for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS. You've been listening to WMKV HealthScope. Join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. for another edition of WMKV HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV Reading, Ohio.